from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in our next forum hour, 50 years ago, the Point Reyes Bird Observatory was founded to study migratory birds. In the decades since, the organization, now called Point Blue Conservation Science and headquartered in Petaluma, has expanded to include wide-ranging ecosystem conservation, work to reduce the effects of habitat loss and climate change on birds and other wildlife. In its 50th anniversary year, Forum will talk with Point Blue about changes in California's bird populations, the health of bird habitats, and threatened birds of the Bay Area, all coming up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Founded 50 years ago as the Point Reyes Bird Observatory to study migratory birds, Point Blue Conservation Science now devotes its time and resources to ecological and climate change research, protection of wildlife, and a range of other priorities, including the study of bird habitats and endangered birds. Headquartered in Petaluma, California, along the Petaluma River, the group also operates the Palo Marin Field Station in Bolinas, where its scientists have been studying bird ecology since 1966. We devote the second forum hour to focusing on all the wide variety of nature-related work and science of Point Blue, and of course, give this hour over to the birds. Let me tell you who is joining us here in studio. I want to welcome, first of all, Ellie Cohen, President and CEO of the Point Blue Conservation Science. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Grant Ballard, who's here in studio, Chief Science Officer with Point Blue Conservation Science. And good morning to you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good to have you. And also say good morning to Ryan Burnett, who joins us from up in Plumas County in a town called Chester, California. He is Sierra Nevada Group Director for Point Blue Conservation Science. And welcome, Ryan Burnett. Do we have you?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I hear you now. Thank you. Thank you all for joining us. Let me begin with Ellie Cohen, who again is President and CEO of Point Blue and is here with us in studio. And this has been quite a metamorphosis. I remember when it was just a bird sanctuary and just concerned mainly with migratory birds, and still is to a great degree. And we will certainly give a lot of attention to birds, I hope, in the course of this hour. But now you've gone into scientific monitoring and as far as the Antarctica and all into so many other things, climate change, protecting shorelines, conserving ocean food beds, marine mammals as well. I mean, it's a wide range of involvement.
Yes. And first, I just want to again thank you so much for having us here today in celebration
Delighted
of our
50th anniversary. Delighted to have you. Yeah, and congratulations on that 50 years.
Thank you so much. Yes, we were founded in 1965 as Point Reyes Bird Observatory with the mission of understanding the migratory birds that come through Point Reyes and helping to interpret about those birds to the public at Point Reyes National Seashore. And since then, I kind of think of our history actually is in three separate parts. The first part being monitoring bird populations and trends and trying to understand how they might be changing over time. Our second phase was more looking at birds in a more ecosystem context, and that really began with the advent of computers being much more easily and readily available to us so that we could crunch the data, and also the hiring of our first statistical ecologist that helped us to understand that within this 25 years of data at the time, we had all kinds of solutions to conservation challenges and also could guide restoration, for example, and other management efforts. And I'd say our third phase was after there was complete breeding failure of Cassin's auklets at the Farallon National Wildlife Refuge on the Farallon Islands, about 27 miles west of here. And that was in 2005 and 2006. It was a big wake-up call for us, and while at the time we couldn't say for sure that it was climate change, it was exactly what was predicted by climate models, where food was available for the Cassin's auklets, a small bird the size of a robin.
Couldn't get any krill, basically.
Couldn't get any krill, exactly. Yeah.
So here are these passionate nature lovers, educators, self-described nerds, but now being involved way beyond birds, leaders in the ecosystem conservation and giving special attention to global warming.
Yes, absolutely. And since that time in 2005 and 2006, it was clear that for us to achieve our mission and work towards our mission of conserving birds, other wildlife, and ecosystems through science, through partnerships, and through outreach, we really had to address climate change. And so our highest priority today is to reduce the impacts of climate change and habitat loss and other environmental impacts from a growing human community on nature so that we can sustain wildlife and humanity into a changing future.
But Grant Ballard's still concerned with migratory birds, shorebirds, about 20 of them here, in fact, different varieties.
Yeah, and we're right in the middle of our – or actually just wrapping up our annual winter shorebird survey, which a lot of the listeners of this show will probably know about. It's a huge volunteer effort that's been going for – well, we started our first one, I think, in 1981, I believe it was. And we enroll hundreds of citizen scientists throughout California to help us assess the shorebird populations.
Assess for essentially concern about endangered species and falling on that list? It's a watch list, right?
Well, it's not just about endangered species, although, of course, we're concerned about any species that is showing signs of rapid decline. But we're just monitoring trends of all these species. So we try to never look at just one species without looking at the whole context of what the larger bird populations are doing and other animals as well.
But there is a conservation watch list, and what does that entail, or what does that involve?
We do participate in helping the California Department of Fish and Wildlife maintain its bird species of special concern for the state of California, and we've relatively recently helped them update that with a look towards the impacts of climate change on those species. So what we call the bird species of future concern, species that we think that are particularly susceptible to climate change impacts.
Well, birds are an indicator species, really. They used to be used in augury, you know, in predicting the future. But in a sense, that's what we're talking about, isn't it, vis-a-vis climate change?
The prototypical canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's important to remember, too, that it's not just one species. In California, we can successfully and very adequately monitor more than 200 species of birds at the same time through the protocols that we've developed. And having that rich array of species, each one reflecting different pieces and aspects of the ecosystem, is incredibly powerful.
And again, Grant Ballard is Chief Science Officer with Point Blue Conservation Science. Ryan Burnett is Sierra Nevada Group Director, Point Blue Conservation Science. You got some different migratory patterns that come under your watch, Ryan, but also birds in the Sierra Nevada. There's been a mixed effect of fires up there. Maybe we ought to begin by talking about what you've discovered and what you've been able to bring to – what you can bring to awareness here.
Sure, yeah. We are all familiar with the increase in fires in recent years in the Sierra Nevada and certainly big fires like the Rim Fire, the largest fire in the Sierra Nevada history, burned over 250,000 acres. So a lot of our work has been looking at the full range, as Grant was describing, of birds in the Sierra Nevada. And so by looking at all the species, we've come to really recognize that these fires that we often call as blanket catastrophic have really important benefits to a lot of species. And so we found that, a number of species, the black-backed woodpecker is one that is kind of the iconic species of burned forest. Its back is black because to blend in with the charred boles of trees. But there's a whole suite of species that actually benefit from fires, including the ones that burn the hottest. And so our work really is focused up here on looking at how we balance an ecosystem. It isn't all about all fires bad or all fires good, but how do we balance the whole system so that we provide for the full array of species, over 200 species of bird that inhabit or visit the Sierra Nevada? They all use very different things, and so that's really what a lot of our work is focused on. And so we're working with the Forest Service especially to help guide how they manage after a fire burns in the Sierra Nevada, especially as we're getting more and more fires as a result of climate change.
And still, at the core of a lot of the work is nature conservancy, I know, and conservation and ecology work. You involved in some of this meadow restoration up there in the Sierra Nevada, too?
Yeah, for sure. It's one of my big passions these days. We know as we're losing our snowpack, I live here in the Feather River watershed, which is a really important one to California. It's part of the headwaters of the State Water Project. But around me, as I look out right now, there are very few peaks that are over 6,000 feet. And the predictions are by the middle of the century, there'll be very little snow left up here in the winter for that to gently melt in the spring and funnel back into our reservoirs. So we know meadows at the headwaters of these places provide a really important role as kind of sponges of the ecosystem. And they suck in all this water during our floods in the winter and early spring and then slowly release it back to the system to go downstream. But unfortunately, a lot of our meadows are in really bad shape. We've degraded them for lots of different reasons, over the last century and a half. In the Sierra Nevada, the flat places are where people went. And so that happens to be our meadow. So we're really working with a whole array of partners to help spearhead meadow restoration across the Sierra Nevada to catalyze those efforts and also make sure that when we put the invest those conservation dollars in the Sierra Nevada meadow restoration, we actually are achieving what we want to achieve for birds, other wildlife, and, you know, the important water benefits, and, you know, including soil carbon. That's another big important piece of meadow restoration.
Again, Ryan Burnett, Sierra Nevada Group Director for Point Blue Conservation Science, and Ellie Cohen is President and CEO of Point Blue Conservation Science. Let's talk about birds somewhat here. I was reading, Ellie, with you, I was reading in Bay Nature, they're writing about vagrant birds and these birds that sort of land during
during a migration,
even into November, and you got warblers and sparrows and all kinds of different birds, high number of songbirds. Now, you've had some real successes, bald eagles, for example. I mean, certainly peregrine falcons have been a success story. What about these birds that are just kind of losing their migration patterns? I mean, there are a lot of them.
So essentially what you're referring to, vagrant birds, means birds that are off their natural track, their natural migration.
And their DNA track, really, yeah.
Sometimes it can be because of something altered in their DNA. Sometimes it could be because they're literally blown off track from heavy winds or storms. And so one of the reasons why we were founded at Point Reyes was because it was a place, and still is today, a place of very high bird diversity. The physical geography of it sticking out into the ocean means that it a lot of different species will land there, commuting different ways in their life cycles. But we do get some that are vagrants, which means that they are out of their normal range. And some of them will end up on the Farallon Islands, and it is actually because of the songbirds on the Farallons in the fall that we first went there in 1968. And since then, in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, we've had Point Blue scientists out there every day and night until today and continuing forward.
So this work on the Farallons, tell us a little more about what it involves. I mean, there's a lot of data collection, yeah?
Yes. The Farallon Islands host 300,000 breeding seabirds. It's the biggest seabird breeding colony in continental United States, south of Alaska. And it provides early warning about changes in the ocean system, as I mentioned, in 2005 and 2006. A big wake-up call about what was happening in the environment around us in terms of a changing climate and changing conditions. But it also gives us insight into the complexity of ecosystems and the health of food webs. So the birds are essentially samplers of the marine food web, and they're telling us what's happening with fisheries. So when we saw the decline in the Cassin's auklets in 2005 and 2006 because of their reliance on krill, and the krill were gone when warm water came out of nowhere all of a sudden in April and May of those years, it told us that probably in a couple of years we're going to see a big decline in salmon, and that's exactly what we saw.
And if I could go off of birds for a moment, Grant Ballard, with you, you've done some work that I think our listeners would really find of interest, and with penguin research up in Antarctica. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah. So Antarctica has been in my sort of annual migration for the last 20 years. This is only the third year in the past 20 that I haven't been spending the summer there, but this time of year.
Envious. I want to get up there. I really love to see it.
Yeah, it is basically as close as I think you can come to going to another planet. You know, it's an amazing experience, and I if everybody could experience it, I think it would probably mean the end of conservation issues, because everyone would realize how what a magnificent and beautiful place we have in Earth. It's just the best of the best. You know, amazing populations of whales and seals and seabirds, including the penguins. And so I work at a colony called Cape Crozier, which is one of the two largest Adélie penguin colonies in the world. And we've been studying how that colony and other colonies nearby are responding to changes in the amount of sea ice and glacial ice in that area. And basically, the sea ice is doing kind of a strange thing. Since 1989 or so, well, actually since 1979, the sea ice in that sector of Antarctica, the Ross Sea where I work, has been increasing, unlike anywhere else on Earth. So it's been increasing at a rate of about 1.5% per year or so. And meanwhile, everywhere else, the Arctic and the Antarctic Peninsula that we hear about so much, the ice is literally disappearing at a rate almost about the same rate. In the Arctic, it's almost twice as fast, actually, that's disappearing. So this does not bode well for animals that depend on sea ice. including Adelie penguins, which are completely reliant on it. But in the Ross Sea, where the sea ice is increasing, we are seeing increases in the numbers of Adelies. So it's a bright spot in conservation.
Well, it's good to hear that bright spot. And by the way, I was sort of get off migratory birds and talk about penguins as opposed to getting even penguins are birds after all, in a sense. I got this citizen I was told you got the citizen science program. I mean, you're the chief scientist here. Rona Weintraub, who's one of your big advocates, mentioned this to me. You got apps now that people can actually send you information?
Yeah, that's a major trend in conservation science and in lots of different kinds of science, of course. But we have been using citizen science data for well over 30 years now. Like I mentioned, the Pacific Flyway Shorebird Survey is largely done by citizen scientists, volunteers. But also we are collaborating with Cornell Lab of Ornithology on their eBird program. We use the eBird data a lot, which is a great program, and it's the largest citizen science program in the world, and is leading to our ability to really basically get a real-time look at where birds are, because literally thousands of people are submitting checklists every day from California, just in California alone, telling us what birds they see and where they see them.
We have an annual State of Birds report, which I was looking at. It mentions very ominously it starts out with a passenger pigeon.
Right, yes, yeah, and we did contribute to that. You know, it's the 100th anniversary of the extinction of the passenger pigeon, and it sort of serves, of course, as a reminder of how dire things can be, because the passenger pigeon was a species that was so numerous nobody could imagine that it could possibly ever go extinct, but it required a certain critical mass for its life history, and once that
some geneticists are talking about bringing it back. By the way,
I think that would be great if we could do that. I'm all for it. But I should also mention that we do citizen science in the ocean as well with whale observations, and we have apps for letting people report where they see whales. And we're trying to work with the Coast Guard and the NOAA sanctuaries to essentially think about where ship traffic should be reduced or slowed down in order to reduce the threat of ship strikes. So a lot of whales are killed by ships coming in and out of the harbor here in San Francisco and other ports. And by using citizen science, we're getting many more basically a much better idea of where the whales are and when there are concentrations and in the middle of shipping lanes, which does happen.
There's so many programs going. It's really fascinating to just keep up with what's come out of Point Blue. What about the STRAW program, Ellie? Can you talk about that?
Sure. The STRAW program is Students and Teachers Restoring a Watershed. And since they were founded in the early 90s, they have restored over 30 miles of riparian or streamside habitat. It's huge. A new study just came out that showed that this kind of riparian restoration is not only good for birds and for fish, but it's also good for reducing floodwater, keeping the waters cooler than they would be if there was no vegetation on the side, keeping the water cleaner, filtering out pollutants, and also sequestering carbon. And sequestering carbon is exciting in that when you restore, you can sequester just, I think it was 3 miles of river restoration can sequester as much carbon as the County of Marin has identified as their goal for reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. It's quite significant.
Can I bring Ryan Burnett in to talk maybe with you, Ryan, a bit about land management in this whole picture? I mean, it plays a central role, especially private land management. I think your organization has 18 California counties now with biologists, and you're trying to secure water and wildlife on many working lands.
Yeah, for sure. One of our exciting new programs, we recognize that conservation can only go so far if you're working with government agencies and others, and such a huge chunk of California is private land. And so we've started a program where we're embedding biologists with one of our partners, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is a federal agency in the Department of Agriculture. And so we know, working with our partners, that if we can get in with them right at the beginning of when they're starting to plan projects and do work, we can be more effective. So we've worked with them together to put biologists that are Point Blue biologists shared within North Natural Resource Conservation Service into their offices. And so they are working directly with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, who works with private ranchers and other private agricultural producers in California to make a difference on those private lands. So some examples of that are, we're working to affect how we graze animals, livestock in the Sierra Nevada foothills, and do a better job there, because I think there's huge potential benefits there for water, for both the quality of water and how we're storing water in the soils to make those soils more productive. That's going to store a lot more carbon, and then there's huge benefits to wildlife. And we're talking about millions of acres in California. We're also working with them in flooded agriculture in the Central Valley. So we have a great program working in the rice in the Sacramento Valley, where we're working to make sure the rice farmers are providing habitat. So we've lost all our wetlands in the Central Valley, or a huge chunk of our wetlands. But these rice farms, when they flood up, can provide a really great habitat for water birds, for our wintering waterfowl, as well as shorebirds. And so just some really cool programs to really take advantage of the possibility of working on these private lands with these. A lot of private landowners are really great stewards of the environment, and how we can bring information to them to help them do a better job. So it's one of our exciting new programs.
Well, a lot of these programs are exciting and certainly herald all sorts of positive things. Let me go back to you, Grant Ballard, and talk about maybe not so positive note. West Nile virus is hitting a wider variety of bird species than thought. I've read as high as half of all species are affected.
Yeah, it's common for birds to carry different kinds of disease, and for the most part, it's not an issue in terms of transmission to humans or to other animals, and it's not even an issue for them necessarily. But generally, the thing that is concerning the most is that when you end up with ecological disturbance, it creates unusual mixing of different species, and you can get things like West Nile virus spreading in unpredictable ways or becoming a bigger issue because there's other factors that are stressing populations. So it's sort of, you know, it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back in some cases. You also have, you know, species that never interacted previously, you know, from totally different parts of the world now because of climate change, for example, reductions in the amount of ice in the Arctic, making it possible for animals to move more freely from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. We just have to be more alert than ever to you know, the possibility of what these are called zoonotic diseases, the diseases especially that can cross from animals to humans. It's something that is a scary concept and, you know, something that we don't actually study that carefully ourselves these days, but we're super alert to.
Certainly mindful of. Yeah. You know, we're talking about a whole range of environmental and ecological things related to nature and restoration of nature, but also talking about birds, because that was really where it put the now Point Blue Conservation Science on the map when they were the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. We certainly would like to hear from you. I know many of you have questions, comments, would like to join this conversation, and there are a number of ways you can do that. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. And I should mention, by the way, that Point Blue has played a role in so many things. The net fishing ban in Central California, you know, all this data that's central to preventing not only birds from getting onto the endangered species, but also white shark hunting. They were involved in many big accomplishments, including various birds under the Environmental Species Act. Join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and Point Blue is celebrating 50 years of protecting and studying California's birds. Members of their organization are here with us. And I was asking off air, can you answer questions from listeners as to, you know, what's happening to my favorite warbler or songbird or whatever? And the answer is to some degree. But the Bay Area Bird Guide is now on our website, and you can certainly – it's embedded in our website, kqed.org/forum. But I know many of you have questions and comments about what we've been talking about. We've been talking about the wide range of work that Point Blue does. Headquartered in Petaluma, they've expanded their work to include wide-ranging ecosystem conservation, working to reduce effects of habitat loss and climate change on birds and other wildlife. And their 50th anniversary year, we're talking about changes in California bird populations, health of bird habitats, threatened birds of the Bay Area. And again, you may want to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or feel free to post questions or comments onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum. You can also join us by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And Ryan Burnett's with us up in Plumas County. He's Sierra Nevada Group Director for Point Blue Conservation Science. And here in studio, Grant Ballard, Chief Science Officer with Point Blue Conservation Science, and Ellie Cohen, President and CEO of Point Blue Conservation Science. And science is a major factor now in the work that they do, obviously. Here's Alice from Palo Alto who writes, Santa Clara County Audubon does two bird counts, one in June and one in December. This work is helpful to Cornell and other ornithological studies. Thank you for that. Becky writes on Facebook, I see so many more crows and much less small birds. What's happening? Ellie?
We've seen a big increase in crows in the area, and it's in part related to development, expanded development, and less habitat available for those birds, and also food availability for them, like open dumps. And so we can do things to not feed them and reduce their populations to what they would normally be without the human influence.
Talk about population and human influence. It's always struck me that one of the most important factors of ecology and environmentalism that is often not given the spotlight as much as it has is the problem of human population. I mean, in many areas it's decreasing and it continues to decrease as people become more mindful of birth control and so forth. But the Earth's population is over 7 billion. And when you think about that in terms of consumers and carbon footprint and so forth, it's major.
It is. Yeah. In fact, a study came out a couple years ago that showed that about 43% of the Earth's land has been altered in some way for agriculture, paved over. And what that means is loss of carbon, loss of ecological function, and loss of the benefits that we get from nature that we all rely upon. So it's very significant. On the other hand, people are part of nature, and we rely on it for our very survival. So for us to be able to work together with nature and ensure that as we address climate change, that we include nature-based solutions as part of the toolbox is critical for our very survival.
Remember the great Woody Allen line, I am two with nature?
We are 7 billion with nature.
Here's Alan who writes, congratulations to Point Blue. As past president of another conservation birding organization, I'm concerned with the lack of ethnic diversity in our organizations. When I look at the Point Blue newsletter, I see nothing but white faces. I am currently working with Kids in Parks, an organization that teaches inner-city kids about our local natural history. This morning, I'll be taking young students on their first birdwatching walk, and last week I did a program at Visitation Valley Middle School on the Farallon Islands. I fear that there is so little ethnic diversity in the conservation birding community that my students will feel unwelcome should they want to pursue a study of nature further. While we all understand the importance of biodiversity, what is Point Blue doing to promote ethnic diversity?
Excellent question. It's a question that we are addressing internally in the organization ourselves, and we would like to increase our diversity and our outreach to communities of color, but also rural communities, and so that we reach out to a broad range of interests, and both culturally, economically, and ethnically. In the end, all of us are part of one human race, and we need to work together. We need to understand the value of nature, and the best way to do that is to be engaged hands-on.
But there is a difficulty in, it's been in the an issue in the environmental movement ever since I can remember of not
Absolutely.
Really being able to draw people of color or ethnic diversity.
Or economic diversity.
Economic diversity, that's right.
Yeah. Something that we're actively trying
big
to
challenges.
Build up is enough money that we can actually
I was thinking about working class people being, you're talking about economic diversity in terms of getting them funds you need.
Yeah, getting the, you know, we have internships that we've done about 1,500 interns over the last 40 years, and we do actively now 60 or 70 new ones every year, and we need to be able to offer those people travel and stipend, and you know, housing is the big one. So it's a challenge for us to be able to maintain those programs going forward, and given the housing prices in the Bay Area in particular.
Let's bring in our callers, and we begin with George. Morning. You're on the air, George. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Great show. I'm 59 years old, and I grew up in the East Foothills of San Jose. And it seemed like I'd see an American kestrel on every third power pole growing up, and a bird that I just loved for its color, and I like the raptors anyway. And I live in Morgan Hill now, and I can't remember the last time I saw an American kestrel around. And I just wonder if the sparrowhawk has disappeared, or I'm just not looking in the right spot, or have you noticed a decline in that population?
Grant Ballard.
Thanks for the question, George. I haven't noticed, and I'm not sure that the data for California in general show any trend for kestrel, although I could check, and you can follow up with me if you'd like to by email. I'm easy to find. But in general, I think kestrels are doing pretty well. They do rely on cavities, which is a problem. So they nest in holes in trees, and they have to they rely on other animals making those holes, as you probably know. So in some places where diversity has gone down, that's an issue. And obviously there's – I think in particular in the South Bay, I've noticed there's definitely increasing starling populations which compete for those spaces with kestrels and other and western bluebirds and other animals, so other birds. So that's potentially an issue in certain parts of the state.
Well, George, we thank you for the question. And as I suspect, we'll probably get a lot of questions about specific birds. But let me remind listeners that the Bay Area Bird Guide is also on our website. Let me go to another caller on. And that's Nate. Good morning. You're on.
Hi. Thanks. I just wanted to – well, first of all, I'm glad we got the idiom of the canary in the coal mine out of the way in the first minute of the show. But – in all seriousness, you know, I think it's important that people around the Bay Area especially think about the fact that in wildlife ecology, birds are a huge indicator as to sort of the health of the ecosystem. And our wetlands, our tidal marshes, are not only valuable as habitat, but they are one of our only sort of natural local carbon sequestration complexes and also a way to do a lot of flood protection. So the Army Corps of Engineers dumped 5 million cubic yards of sediment that they dredged out of the bay in the ocean this year that could be used for doing much, much more to buffer, protect, and expand our tidal marshes. And I'd finally just plug a project called the Live Edge Adaptation Project, or LEAP, that will be unveiled early this year. You can Google that, but that's looking at ways to actually build and create habitat so that, as Point Blue studies have published and shown, the rising rate of sea level rise that's going to drown our marsh plains, we can sort of circumvent that if we get into actually progressive, proactive habitat creation instead of just retroactive restoration projects. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Nate. That's a great example of what Ellie was talking about, a nature-based solution. The tidal marshes are able to maintain their elevation above sea level as sea level rises and offer great flood protection and also, of course, wildlife habitat and carbon sequestration and just places for humans to enjoy, you know, the beauty of our bay. But we are limited in – or the marshes are limited by how much sediment is available. And you're absolutely right. It's a major issue that today, due to several factors, it's a complicated situation. Most of the sediment that's available is actually getting dumped outside of the bay. So we're hoping that some regulations can change and we can put that sediment to work.
Grant Ballard is Chief Science Officer for Point Blue Conservation Science. Do you get called CSO? I mean, there's CFOs and CEOs and CSOs.
Exactly.
Pete wants to know, what do your guests think of bird feeders? Do they have a negative artificial impact on bird diversity and ecology?
Bird feeders can be great if you keep them clean and free of bacteria that can cause disease in birds that rely on them. And you also need to keep it up through the winter. So if you are feeding birds, you need to ensure that you keep it throughout the entire season so that they don't get stuck midwinter with no food available to them.
And again, if you have questions or would like to join us, and we are taking specific bird questions, I know there are a lot of them, 866-733-6786 is a number to call, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Here's Michael from Oakland. Michael, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for your efforts in protecting our birds. A study that was released 2 years ago estimated that between 1.4 and 3.7 billion, with a B, billion birds are killed each year in the U.S. by house cats that are allowed to roam outside. So these are not feral cats per se, but actually domesticated cats. And even though most cat owners in the study did not believe that their cats killed birds, video cameras showed otherwise. And I just was curious as to how much of an issue this was for migrating birds.
It's an important issue, I believe. In fact, let me just dovetail, and thank you, Michael, for that call. Your question with another one from Dave. I'm looking at it in an email here. He says, please talk about cats, both feral and domesticated outdoor cats. As far as I'm concerned, unless we address the cats loose in our neighborhoods and in Point Reyes National Seashore, we're whistling Dixie. Until a biologist tells me otherwise, I'll assume cats and songbirds cannot co-inhabit. And am I correct? This is a politically radioactive issue. Could it be that contributors to environmental causes also embrace their cats and put out milk on the back porch?
Could be.
It's a great question, and it is a huge issue. You know, Michael was exactly right about those numbers. That study was shocking. It basically dwarfs all of the other risks.
2 billion.
Yeah, all of the other risks to birds combined are dwarfed by the issue of cats in America. And that it's something that people are starting to wake up to. I think a lot of people who are bird lovers do know this. And if they have cats, they keep them indoors. And, you know, it's not enough to put a bell on a cat. It doesn't work. The cats are very, very stealthy, and they're basically designed to kill birds. They are
well. They do kill rats
really,
and mice too.
they kill all kinds of things, but they are very, very good at killing birds. And so it's a huge issue. And yeah, please keep your cats indoors.
Let me thank Michael for the call. You want to add something, Ellie Cohen?
Yeah, just that in terms of climate smart conservation, we want to give species as much time as possible to adapt to the changes ahead, and that means keeping their numbers up. And each one of us can contribute to that by doing things like keeping cats indoors, by planting native species in their yards, by planting grasses that sequester carbon and ensuring that all of that bare ground is covered. We can have carbon gardens and bird gardens, and we can keep our cats indoors.
And we'll bring on another caller, and that's Mickey from San Anselmo. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. First, I just wanted to thank you all for the great work that you guys do at Point Blue. You're fabulous. And secondly, my question is, what do you think our biggest challenges in terms of climate change, and how do you think we can best address it?
Maybe Ryan Burnett would like to weigh in here. Ryan, we haven't heard from you in a while. Some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the challenge of climate change seems overwhelming at times because we're, you know, how can we individually, you know, affect what's going on in China or India or what's going on in Paris right now? But really where we're focused as an organization, and I think all of Ellie just eloquently stated how individuals can do it, is that we can focus on nature-based solutions. So one is providing the space and the time and taking the other stressors off of our wildlife population so that they have time to adapt. We know our climate has gone through changes over time, but never under all the pressure, other pressures we've put our ecological systems under. So we're really, I think the focus here is to look at nature-based solutions. So take, for instance, Sierra Meadows. They're in a degraded state. And we've kind of evaluated that under climate change scenarios where we get more of these rain on snow events, where we get lots of floodwaters in the middle of winter, these places are going to further degrade. And they're going to dry out, and the warmer climate is going to turn them into conifer forest or sagebrush flats, and we're going to lose these important wetlands in the Sierra Nevada. But if we go in and restore them now, today, we can make them far more resilient to the changes climate's bringing about and allow them to adapt to a changing climate. They may not be exactly the same thing that they are today in 50 years, but they'll function ecologically and provide all those benefits of water and carbon and wildlife. So I think that's really the place we can really focus here in California on, and California is a leader in this, in climate adaptation, that really focus on nature-based solutions to make our systems, make our wildlife populations more resilient to these things by easing the other stresses that are going on them. We know we're kind of locked in. We signed the contract on a couple degrees of warming as it is right now. So we know we have to do something no matter what. We're still working on the carbon issues. We have to address that. But right now we already are called to action to make a difference in securing these areas and make them more resilient and more adaptable to climate change.
And again, Ryan Burnett is with us this morning from Chester, California, up in Plumas County. He's Sierra Nevada Group Director for Point Blue Conservation Science. Let me go right to another caller here and go to the Mojave Desert and welcome Ted. Ted, you're on.
Hi. Thank you, Michael. Great show. I just had a question for your guest, and I can take this answer off the air. How does one prevent birds of any kind from flying into the windows around the kitchen and the sliding glass door? It's just an awful thing to see happen, and I don't know what I can do about it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the question.
Yeah, there are Ellie some Cohen. Great resources online. There are new kinds of glass that are etched in a very subtle way that is not so perceptible to the human eye, that allows all the light in, but that the birds can see so that they don't crash into it. That's the best. But if you can't do that, there are things that you can buy online that deter birds. And if you look it up, you can look on Cornell Labs' website or at Point Blue, and we can direct you there.
And let me go to some emails. Here's Sylvia from Inverness, who writes, thank you for all your important and wonderful work. She's speaking of Point Blue here. Goes on to say, in your backyard, the Point Reyes Giacomini Wetlands was a former dairy farm restored in 2008 to wetlands. The ever-increasing number of hunters to Tomales Bay since 2009 is an unintended consequence of the wetlands achieving its purpose to serve as a refuge for migrating birds and wildlife. By 2009, word got out that hunters could lie in wait right at the flyway entrance to the wetlands in the Tomales Bay Ecological Reserve and pick off the birds as they try to make it there, an ecological trap. They shoot in the exact spot popular with hikers, kayakers, birdwatchers, and horseback riders, bordered by heavily traveled roads, including California Highway 1 and a permanent residential community. When hunters are out there shooting, the entire ecosystem is disrupted. Can you see this happening in the Bolinas Lagoon, Muir Beach, Richardson Bay, and Tiburon? And they legally can shoot 100 days in a row. Can you speak about this?
Yeah, it's a complicated situation for sure. It is an unintended consequence, in my opinion, as well. It's a fantastic restoration project. If you haven't seen it, it's an amazingly great place to see birds and a huge success. It does have hunters going to it.
They're picking them off there.
So the hunting issue, well, in general, we think of hunters as major contributors to conservation. They have done an amazing job of contributing lots of money and good ideas about how to maintain, in particular, waterfowl populations, which has been a huge success in general. So,
are they on board in terms of the reserve?
Yeah, absolutely. Hunting dollars are still a major part of how conservation gets done in America. And it's important to recognize that. So there's a need to have a dialogue, and if there's disturbance, it sounds like there is a lot of disturbance there. I haven't actually personally witnessed this, but
she's also concerned that it could spread too,
right? Yeah. And this, you know, we have to keep talking. In general, you know, the hunters that I've interacted with have been extremely reasonable, and there's, you know, no reason not to, you know, to talk to them about what the regulations should be around that particular location or other locations.
Here's Ben, who writes, does Point Blue track lease terns? And if so, have you noticed anomalies this year? Usually the lease terns have left the bay by September, but I saw them several times along Alameda shoreline in October. My birding friends think I'm going blind. Have others observed a later migration recently?
That's a great question. Maybe Ryan knows, but we do study the lease terns, and we have a biologist on our staff, Meredith Elliott, who I'm sure would be happy to tell you all about lease terns, so please get in touch with her. And maybe Ryan, just check with
her. Yeah, Ryan, you have something to add here?
Yeah, I don't know specifically for how long the lease tern stayed, but we are definitely seeing beyond, you know, climate change and things going on, El Nino winter coming up. We've had this amazing warm, what they call the blob of warm water off the Pacific coast of California, which has resulted in lots of varied migration patterns of ocean-dependent wildlife. You know, for instance, we're seeing common dolphins all the way up into the San Francisco area, which they're often, you know, stayed in Southern California. So there's things like that going on and anomalies both related to the drought and, you know, this anomalous warm water blob that's definitely affecting wildlife around the bay.
There are late migrations. There are more of those, in fact.
And also birds that have never been here before in any numbers are becoming common. Things like brown boobies, for example, that, you know, really are common in Mexico and throughout the Caribbean, of course, but making their way north. And now that we're having a new record year this year for the number of brown boobies that are basically resident on the Farallon Islands, and we would not be surprised if they start breeding there in the next couple of years.
And again, you can join us 866-733-6786. Here's Max from San Leandro. Hi, Max.
Hello. Hi. I wanted to let people know about a wonderful program that happened end of July that's now on video. A conservation biologist named David Theodoropoulos, along with a firefighter who is one of the people called in by Oakland and Berkeley mayors to write up a report after the big fire. They both were speaking and talking about restoration efforts around. Hello?
Yeah, it sounded like we lost you there for a couple.
My phone had shut off. So anyhow, it's at eastbaypesticidealert.org on the wildfire pages. They talk about some of the dangers sometimes of restoration projects, of unintended consequences. So with the plan right now to down all the eucalyptus and other trees in the hills of the East Bay and also happening at Mount Sutro, the plan is actually to convert to grasslands. So the firefighter was pointing out and did a demonstration about how completely and utterly dangerous that would be. We're in this urban and wildlands interface area. So we have to look at what we actually have right here, right now. And to convert our hills into grasslands is would just be an absolute fire danger. It's a wonderful program and full of a lot of slides showing patterns of migration around the world over time. That's part of what the conservation biologist was doing. And it's just a great opportunity for thought and discussion, again, at eastbaypesticidealert.org. And another wonderful website for restoration issues is milliontrees.me. Lots of good discussion, debate where that's appropriate, and so on. Really good cited information.
Well, thank you for bringing those to our attention and for the plugs you've given them, and I thank you for the call. Here's Brendan, who sends in the following question. He says, I work in the Presidio of San Francisco, currently restoring a newly daylighted section of the Tennessee Hollow watershed. And within the past few weeks, we have seen an increase of wonderful bird species, including a great egret.
Fantastic. There's no question that restoration, even on a small scale, allows species to come back and to increase in numbers. And we also know that restoration is critical as a tool in addressing climate change.
It's Malcolm who writes, my cousin had a home in the Sonoma wine region but was forced to move because the vineyard that bordered her property on two sides began using increasingly toxic pesticides. The resulting effect on the health of birds and wildlife in general was a major concern. I wonder how much that issue concerns you.
It's definitely a concern. Pesticides in general, obviously, through time have been issues for birds, going back to DDT, obviously, and eggshell thinning, in particular for brown pelicans and other species, peregrine falcons you mentioned earlier, and huge success in regulating that once it was known to be a specific issue. So that's always the concern. There's an ongoing need for vigilance and for research and monitoring to understand when there is an issue and specifically what the issue is and what can be done about it. At this point, we have been studying to some extent the pesticides and vineyards interactions with birds and I'm not aware of any, really bad issues, but, definitely something that we keep an eye on.
Well, the caller who gave plugs for organizations prompts me. I know that Point Blue does a lot of work with young people, has a major internship program, and reaches out in terms of education. In your website, you talk about training the next generation and really getting them involved, and that's heartening to hear. If people want to get involved, maybe at this point, how can they?
That would be wonderful. We'd love for people to be more engaged, and they can find out more information at pointblue.org, or they can email me at ecohen@pointblue.org, and I'd be happy to direct them to the right staff person.
Lots of volunteer and citizen science opportunities?
Many, many opportunities on many different levels to help out and to make a difference for our future.
Can people go to the Farallons with you guys?
People can volunteer. The Farallons are off limits to the public, but there are some volunteer opportunities through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that is a potential.
And we'll bring another caller on. Adam joins us from Petaluma. Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My wife and I live in Petaluma, and we were hiking. There's a kind of a wetlands right across from Point Blue's main setup there in Petaluma, and this was a few years ago. We came across an injured bird. And it was clearly injured. Normally, we try not to disturb things, but it was clearly injured. And we brought it into Point Blue's headquarters there. And we were treated very rudely. We were turned away, and we weren't given any advice. They didn't want to touch the bird or help us in any way. And since then, we've had a real bad taste in our mouth about this organization.
Well, I'm very sorry you had that experience. We don't handle injured animals, but no one should be treating you rudely, and that's a pretty rare comment on Point Blue. So I apologize on behalf of everyone, and hope you'll come by again and look me up, and I'll give you a tour and give you the red
carpet
treatment.
Be nice and civil, yeah.
Absolutely. I apologize for that.
Well, thanks for the call. Here's Julie who writes, I remember riding past the Audubon Canyon Ranch growing up in the Bay Area. I don't understand why another nonprofit addressing the same mission was established right down the road. It only adds another administrative department that theoretically needs to be supported by a limited number of donors. Why wasn't some kind of partnership created to provide sustainable fundraising for both? One board, one program manager, one development plan. Also, with the Feather River Canyon providing an important bird habitat and our need to build water storage facilities to match the outrageous amount of development allowed to flourish in California, how will this shake out in an equitable manner?
Well, I'll take the first part of that. Maybe Ryan can take the second part. So with regards to Audubon Canyon Ranch, which is a wonderful partner organization, we have partnered with them over a long period of time. And in fact, they helped us get the headquarters that we had for probably 25 years or so was on their property. And they gave us a very good deal on it. So we've collaborated, and there are synergies, and there are advantages to having separate organizations, and their mission is different from ours. I realize that it can be confusing for different members sometimes. But if you look at what ACR has done with their visitor center and the great conservation work around the egrets and herons that they've focused on there locally, it's been fantastic work, and it's work that we haven't done other than to some of our staff have, you know, occasionally helped out with that work.
Well, the second part of that question, Ryan Burnett, to you, though, seconds left here, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so, you know, the Feather River Canyon, it has a series of dams that the Pacific Gas and Electric Company owns and provides a source of clean energy, but there's obviously impacts, we know, of putting up dams and, you know, the salmon are no longer allowed to get up the river. So it's a big challenge for climate change will be how we've built a whole system of dams and reservoirs to deal with a system that will no longer exist, you know, in the future, one that's more rain-driven and less snow. So that's going to be a huge challenge.
We'll have to leave it there because we are flat out of time. But thanks to Ryan Burnett, Sierra Nevada Group Director of Point Blue Conservation Science, to Grant Ballard, the Chief Science Officer, and Telly Cohen, President and CEO, who all spent this hour with us. And again, you can go online and check our Bay Area food, their Bay Area bird guide there. It's on our website. And you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. We thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.